This is Dennis Tech of Radio Birdman, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Do you enjoy the arts, have an interest in art classes and meeting your local creative community? Then join us at the Athens Cultural Center on the first Friday of each month from 5 to 7 p.m. View our latest exhibition over free nibbles and drinks hosted by our ACC board members, and get to know us. We are at 24 2nd Street in Athens and online at athensculturalcenter.org. We look forward to meeting you.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the Community Theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Igers Kildas and Louisa Sabin Kildas of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tamaru in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Wednesday, October 18th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. The New York Times reports that Representatives Elise Stefanik and Mark Molinaro both backed Jim Jordan on October 17th in his first attempt to become Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Stefanik even nominated Jordan, but his effort failed with 20 Republicans voting for other candidates. Both Hudson Valley Democrats, Paul Tonko and Pat Ryan, voted for Democrat Hakeem Jeffries, who got 12 more votes than Jordan. New York's Lee Zeldin, who does not currently hold any office and lost to Governor Kathy Hochul last November, got 3 votes to become Speaker of the House. Read more about this story in the New York Times. Noah Zweifel reports in the Altamont Enterprise that for the first time since 2017, the Rensselaerville Town Board election has a contested race. Incumbent Brian Wood is seeking re-election, backed by both the Republican and Democratic parties, against former Highway Superintendent and Town Board member Randall Bates, who is backed by the Republican Party, and Patricia Byrne, a sociologist and political newcomer endorsed by the Democratic Party. Wood and Bates are also running on the conservative line. The Albany County Board of Elections reports that Rensselaerville currently has 1,455 enrolled voters, and of those, 595 are Democrats, 373 are Republicans, 63 count themselves as conservatives, 6 signed up for the Working Families Party, and 3 are Green Party members. The remaining 415 are not registered with any party. The story quotes each candidate about their views on local issues ahead of voting, which takes place between October 28th and November 7th this fall. Read more about this story in the Altamont Enterprise. Amelia Teasdale reports in the Upstater that in Chatham this fall, the election pits incumbent town supervisor Donnell Collins on the Republican and Chatham for All ballot lines against Christopher W. Spencer on the Democratic and Chatham Neighbors lines. Whoever wins is supervisor for the next 4 years. In the same election, there are 2 town board seats with Vance Pitkin and Timothy Macker on the Republican and Chatham for All ballot lines, and John Wapner and Angus Eaton on the Democratic and Chatham Neighbors lines. Those town board seats are also for 4 years. Voting this fall takes place from October 28th until November 7th. The story also includes quotes and positions from the candidates. Read more about this story in the Upstater. And Ben Mitchell reports for News 10 that state police are offering free childcare seat checks on October 21st in Hudson. Checks on child car seats is from 4 to 7 p.m. Saturday, October 21st at Henry Hudson Riverfront Park. For more information, contact Sergeant Larry Elderman at 518-828-3388 or Larry news.eldeman@hudsonpoliceny.org. See more about the story at the News 10 website. See more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, October 18th. Local early morning temperatures range from 44 degrees in Roxbury to 50 in Voorheesville. Regional average soil temperature is 56 degrees. Today will be partly cloudy with a high of 61 at 3 p.m. Overnight, temperatures fall to 44 degrees, then tomorrow bounce back up to 64 at 3 p.m. Winds kick up a bit, making it definitely jacket weather. 52 degrees overnight takes us into a wet-looking Friday. Saturday isn't looking any better. An inch of rain is expected to fall throughout the day, and we get a high of 60 degrees. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 12:12 a.m., high tide at 5:25 a.m., low tide again at 12 o'clock p.m., then high tide once again at 5:42 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 57 degrees, and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 5:57 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:07 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be slow at 331 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 57, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
This is really me now. No more hiding. Listen, we're all worried. We're all in pain. That comes with having eyes, with having ears. But just remember one thing. It can't get any worse. It can only get better. Quitting is not going to make you strong. Living will. So just hang on and hang in there. You know, I know all about the hating and the sneering. I'm a member of the why bother generation myself. But why did I bother to come out here tonight? And why did you? I mean, it's time. It begins with us, not with politicians, the experts, or the teachers, but with us. With you and with me, the ones who need it most. I believe, with everything that's in me, that the whole world is longing for healing. Even the trees, the earth itself, are crying out for it. You can hear it everywhere. It's the same kind of healing I desperately needed, and finally feel has begun with you.
Next, we're going to hear from the Master Gardeners at the Cornell Cooperative Extension. They have a podcast called Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. And each week on WGXC, we'll hear different segments from the show focused on local gardening and gardening for the time of year it is.
Hi, and welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. I'm Tim Kenalty.
And I'm Jean Thomas. We have Bob Bifus with us today, and the topic of our conversation is ginseng. Now, I'll admit I thought this was a nice, easy project since Bob is famously, in our area, the ginseng guy. Then I started researching. I started with looking up Bob's career and how he became the ginseng guy. Bob has his master's degree from Cornell on raising ginseng and never looked back. Many of you are familiar with Bob's weekly advice column in most area local papers. How many do you contribute to, Bob?
I think there's about 6 or 7 different newspapers that I send it out to. Today, though, newspapers are all owned by one or two companies. So I think there's maybe 2 or 3 major publishers that I'm sending it to. But it appears in at least 6 or 7 local newspapers.
Yeah, I've seen it at least that many. I'm going to have to start counting because I think there's more.
And then, of course, I read the column and I record that on WRIP. Every Friday and Saturday morning, they run that spot over and over again. And it's basically, I'm just reading my newspaper column. So it's on the radio every week on Friday and Saturday morning at about 6:30 in the morning.
No one escapes Bifus.
You're stuck with me. Yeah.
So, Bob, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your career. We ask everybody this to kind of see what they're interested in. We're not looking for a list of credentials, but tell us about what you have been interested in and what your career has been.
I've had a great career at Cornell Cooperative Extension. 31 years I worked here, and pretty much started at the bottom as a part-time summer assistant, made myself indispensable, became an agent, started out in horticulture mostly, and then became interested in natural resources about when I went back for my master's degree, which they were kind enough to pay for, and that's when I became interested in natural resources in general, but ginseng in particular. And so I pretty much spent the last, I would say, 15, 18 years of my career with Cooperative Extension working on agroforestry and most specifically working on ginseng. And I won't even begin to try to hit, you know, the highlights, but if I had to pick one event that really pushed me, it was the Ginseng Y2K Conference, which was an international conference that we hosted here in Greene County in the year 2000, which literally put Greene County on the map and sort of helped to get me launched in my ginseng career. And that was really the highlight. From that came this building that we're sitting in now. That was the start of that. We made money on the conference, and it was wildly successful and attracted some national attention. And we parlayed it into building this agroforestry resource center, which we're sitting in right now. So if we're not for ginseng, we wouldn't be sitting in this beautiful building today.
Okay, now explain to me again, why is ginseng so fascinating to you?
Well, ginseng is kind of the poster child of rare and endangered plants. I asked this to the leading ginseng researchers like Jim McGraw, and they said, well, you know, ginseng is special because of its history and because of its status, you know, being a threatened and endangered plant, yet it's something that's grown. So ginseng itself is a fascinating plant. Of all the woodland plants, probably the most fascinating. And I have personal history with it, which I don't want to go into because it'll take forever, but I'm absolutely convinced that taking ginseng is what allowed me to get through graduate school. Hadn't been to college in 13 years, and I went back to Cornell, and I was absolutely petrified that I was going to flunk out and embarrass myself, and started taking ginseng then on a regular basis, and I think it changed my life. So when it came time to declare my major, which was after one semester at Cornell, I asked my professor if I could work on ginseng, and he said yes, and that's how it all began.
So you have this history with ginseng, which is very cool, but there's also a history of the plant itself. It was started as a novelty crop, right? And even Daniel Boone was a ginseng entrepreneur. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. It was never really a novelty crop. It was actually North America's first major export to the rest of the world, particularly China, but basically through Europe to China, but going back to the 1700s, 1715 is when ginseng was actually first exported from North America. So there's a long, long tradition. There's stories that George Washington borrowed money to finance the American Revolution from people who dealt in ginseng. Yeah. So the history goes way even beyond Daniel Boone. But the Daniel Boone story is that he had a shipment of 40 tons of ginseng on a barge on the Ohio River, which somehow overturned, and they lost that entire crop. But the story goes that within 3 months, he was able to gather another 40 tons of ginseng and export that. So, yeah, Dan, he's definitely got some history with ginseng.
I think that's how he afforded to get all those raccoon skin caps, right?
I heard of a language thing about tons, that ton, T-U-N, is what they lost, not a 2,000 pounds a piece, but yes. A ton is a barrel.
That has been hotly debated.
Yeah.
That's really, I've heard both sides of it, too. And the latest version I heard is from a historian who I just wrote a wonderful book about ginseng diggers and the history of ginseng digging in Appalachia. And Luc Manger is his name. And he basically says, you know, the 30 tons being 2,000 pounds per barrel, he said, is not unreasonable. So I assumed also that 30 tons, because they did refer to a barrel as a ton, and ginseng was often shipped in barrels. But according to Luke, very possible that it was actually 32,000-pound tons that were on the barge.
Controversy. I love it.
Still historical
I
controversy.
I love it. Okay, so it's an old-established crop in the U.S., but now there's a difference between American and Asian ginseng. Why were the Chinese so excited about the American ginseng when they already had their own at home?
Asian ginseng is a different species than American ginseng, and they're different medicines. They're clearly different medicines, but 1,000 years ago, Asian ginseng had become very, very scarce and rare, virtually extinct in most of Asia. And so when wild American ginseng was discovered, and the plants look virtually identical, if I had two of them growing side, you couldn't tell them apart. And so when this plant became available, the Chinese welcomed it, but they immediately determined that it was a different medicine. It was not the same. It was equally good. If anything, it was better than Asian ginseng, but it was a different medicine. But it's been part of their traditional medicine ever since 1700s. I mean, ginseng itself is about 2,000-year history in China. But American ginseng from, let's say, 1715 onward has been a really important part of their medicine. But it is a different medicine.
So I know that I couldn't just go back in my backyard and plant ginseng. It needs specialized conditions. But you have pioneered some methods. It's called forest farming and wild simulated methods to grow ginseng. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my efforts in developing wild simulated ginseng as a crop has to do with the fact that the wild ginseng commands so much of a higher price than cultivated ginseng. Cultivated ginseng grown under artificial shade cloth, there's thousands of acres of that are being produced in North America. Well, the price for that particular type of ginseng, which is grown for 3, maybe 4 years under shade cloth, treated with all sorts of chemicals, the price of that ginseng right now is about $15 a pound, whereas the price of woodland ginseng runs anywhere from $800 to $2,000 a pound. So we're talking a significant, of course, the yields are much, much lower. However, and the growing season is much, much lower. It takes about 10 years to grow a crop in the woods, whereas, again, 3 years for the artificially shaded ginseng. But the value of it is just so much more. But the real bonus in wild simulated ginseng is that it protects the forest resource. It is something that keeps the trees. There's no pesticides applied. There's no tillage. There's no chemicals. It basically, you do timber stand improvement, which is an important forestry management topic, basically to make the site suitable for ginseng. So it really does tend to keep land sequestered in a way that is very, very beneficial for all the environments of the forest. So growing wild simulated ginseng is definitely a win-win situation for the forest and for the landowner if he's got a suitable spot. Not all land is suitable.
Does it directly benefit the trees around it when it grows in some chemical way or something like that?
That's a very good question. I think the more we learn about the interactions between forest communities, I think the more we learn that there are some roles that are being played and there is some communication that's going on between trees and herbaceous plants. And I think the more we study, the more we're finding that, yes, that is indeed the case. I can't specifically cite any research to back that up, but my gut feeling is that the more we learn, the more we will discover that there are communities in the forest, and we need to recognize that.
Okay, so we're encouraging forest farming. I know across the road from the ACRA office, we have test plots and things going on over there with a lot of forest farming. How big is the industry, in quotes, of growing American ginseng? Both the shade cloth kind of stuff and the naturalized.
Well, the shade cloth, obviously 95% of the ginseng that is grown in North America is grown under shade cloth. Ontario actually produces the most. They harvest about 6 to 10 million pounds of ginseng a year. Wisconsin harvests about 3 to 4 million pounds of ginseng per year. We have no figures on how much ginseng is actually being grown in the forest. We do have data on how much so-called wild ginseng is being exported each year. That's very carefully tracked. And that amounts to about 50 or 60,000 pounds a year. I suspect that most of that figure is actually being grown by someone in some small manner. And it's not just people are going out and finding wild ginseng. So I think that people have been growing ginseng in the woods for hundreds of years, but people won't admit that because they won't get paid the price that wild ginseng commands, you know. So it's a, there's no incentive for people to say that, yeah, that ginseng is actually, I grew it in the woods, because they're going to get paid the price of wild ginseng, which, as I said, is substantially higher than cultivated ginseng.
That was an excerpt of an interview from the Nature Calls Conversations from the Hudson Valley podcast from the master gardeners of the Cornell Cooperative Extension for Columbia and Greene Counties. You can hear the full episode at the Cornell Cooperative Extension webpage or in the WGXC archives at wgxc.org or at cccolumbiagreene.org.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
A vote today to make the architect of a nationwide abortion ban, a vocal election denier, and an insurrection insider to the Speaker of this House would be a terrible message to the country and our allies.
California Democrat Pete Aguilar says Hartwright Representative Jim Jordan failed to win the vote for Speaker because the Ohio Republican is regarded by many, some even in his party, as a legislative terrorist. Aguilar blamed the chaos in the House on extreme partisanship. 20 in the GOP refused to back Jordan when he could only lose 4. He's expected to try again today. With aid to Israel and Ukraine waiting, Colorado Republican Ken Buck told MSNBC if Jordan isn't elected, he'd support giving acting Speaker Patrick McHenry full power for 30 days.
Undoubtedly, we would give him full power so that if there is an Israeli package, supplemental spending package that comes over from the White House, we would have the ability to vote on that.
This comes as Secretary of State Antony Blinken announces President Biden is set to visit Israel to reaffirm U.S. solidarity.
President Biden will again make clear, as he's done unequivocally, that Israel has the right and indeed the duty to defend its people from Hamas and other terrorists.
With Israelis still counting the dead from Hamas attacks, hundreds have died when a hospital in Gaza was struck. It's unclear if it was hit by Israeli bombing or an Islamic Jihad missile that went off course. Jewish American peace advocates are protesting outside the Capitol today, calling for de-escalation and ceasefire. Jay Saber with Jewish Voice for Peace says they support a bill sponsored by Missouri progressive Cori Bush to stop what some call a potential genocide in Gaza.
The Jewish community is rising up in numbers that are completely unprecedented, pushing our politicians to make the right call to end a genocide that is unfolding in real time.
Bush is offering her resolution as an alternative to one giving Israel unrestricted support. 2,700 people in Gaza and 1,400 people in Israel have been killed in the war so far. Justice Amy Coney Barrett is the latest to voice her support for the U.S. Supreme Court adopting an ethics code.
I think it would be a good idea for us to do it, particularly so that we can communicate to the public exactly what it is that we're doing in a clearer way.
Barrett's comments match those of Justices Elena Kagan and Brett Kavanaugh. ProPublica reports that Justice Clarence Thomas spoke at a fundraiser for the conservative Koch brothers. Finally, to Arizona, Republicans Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham have again lost a court bid to ban voting machines. Fincham, who ran for Secretary of State, and Lake, who's running for Senate, claimed voting machines are untrustworthy. The court called their claims hypothetical conjecture. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Hey, how are you?
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. In the 2024 election, Arizona voters may have the opportunity to adopt single-ballot open primaries and ranked choice voting if organizers of two competing proposals succeed in gathering enough signatures. The Arizona Daily Independent reports that both Better Ballot Arizona and Make Elections Fair filed in September to begin the signature-gathering process to add their proposals to the November 2024 ballot. Both initiatives would change the state constitution to allow for single-ballot open primaries, open because Democrats, Republicans, third-party supporters, and unaffiliated voters could all participate in the primary process. Unaffiliated and third-party voters comprise almost 36% of the state's voters. Better Ballot Arizona's proposal would have the top five candidates move forward to the general, where ranked choice voting would decide the election, similar to Alaska's system. The Make Elections Fair proposal would have the legislature create a law stipulating how many candidates move to the general election, rather than mandating the number of candidates and the use of ranked choice voting. Open primaries allow voters more choices than just the dominant party candidates and give third-party or independent candidates an opportunity to compete. More candidates in the general can also mitigate the election of extreme candidates. Signatures must be submitted by July 3, 2024. We have more on these proposals at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
I'm Tom Rowe from Wave Farm with the WGXC Radio News. The New York Times reports that on October 9th, Canadian Broadcasting stopped airing the daily so-called Long Dash. Since 1939, CBC Radio in Canada had broadcast a message familiar to generations of Canadians. Quote, the beginning of the Long Dash indicates exactly 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, unquote, is how it went In its most recent iteration, people literally synchronized their watches to the daily tone from the CBC. But no more. The CBC, Canada's national public broadcaster, said that accuracy issues are a key reason for dropping the message. People still listen to the radio over the air, but also on satellite and online, and those broadcasts can be delayed for several seconds or more. For many listeners, the moment they hear the long dash might not be exactly 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, but 1:00:004 or something. Here is an excerpt of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's news report about the ending of the long dash on CBC Radio.
1 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time.
The long dash started on November 5th, 1939, and at the time it was a very important thing for Canadians coast to coast.
The CBC brings you the Dominion Observatory official time signal.
People were tuning their clocks on their wrists at their home, their grandfather clocks, to that tone. You had the railroads that used it, shipping companies that used it, so it was a very vital tool.
The beginning of the long dash indicates exactly...
The last broadcast of the dash was at 1 p.m. Eastern on October 9th, 2023. It existed for 84 years, so technically it is our longest running radio program by far, even if it was only for a few seconds.
Well, the long dash just reminds me of my childhood. So I started doing CBC Towels. So then I did the second one about how would you know it's 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock. It's sort of a punctuation mark in my life. It's a heartbeat type thing. I'm just sentimental. I don't want it to end. It has nothing to do with selling tea towels. It's part of who we are, so it's. I feel sad about it.
You can hear a soothing silence, then a beep.
One person, they have this nostalgic memory of lunchtime because whenever they heard that tone, their mother would start cooking lunch. So the majority of people are very sad that it's gone and that it's kind of signaling an end to an era.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
On Monday, October 16th, as Israel prepared to invade Gaza, more than 100 peace activists gathered at the Federal O'Brien Building in downtown Albany to call for an immediate ceasefire and release of all hostages. The event was sponsored by the Palestinian Rights Committee, Jewish Voices for Peace, and Saratoga Peace Alliance. Most of the speakers condemned the recent violence by Hamas, as well as the ongoing violence that Israel has inflicted on Palestinians for decades, turning the occupied territories into an open-air prison camps. Speakers blamed the Biden administration and other elected officials for their carte blanche support for Israel rather than seeking peace and justice for all the residents of the Middle East. As Tom Ellis of the Palestinians' Rights Committee observed, if there is one thing we have learned since October 7th, it is that Hamas and the Israeli government are spectacularly talented in bringing out the worst in each other. Karen Cormelli of Jewish Voices for Peace, a granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, recounted how she had fled Israel at the age of 16 to avoid the mandatory military service that all young people are required to engage in, which often is centered on the oppression of Palestinian civilians. We hear from Reverend John Paulberg of the New York State Councils of Churches, Rabbi David Freeman of Jews United Against Zionism, Karen Cormelli, Tom Ellis, and former Daily Gazette journalist Carl Strock.
John Paulberg, I've been concerned about issues in Palestine and Israel for several years now. I serve on the executive committee of the New York State Council of Churches and am regional coordinator for Churches for Middle East Peace.
What do you think should be happening at this point as Israel, you know, is kind of leveling Gaza at the moment?
Yeah, well, speaking for many of the churches who have issued statements, we are decrying the violence that Hamas has inflicted on the people of Israel, calling for release of hostages, and calling on Israel to restrain from violence and to provide humanitarian relief to those who are in Gaza. We've also been saying for many, many years that the underlying issue of Israeli occupation and oppression of Palestinians needs to stop because that only leads to the kind of violence that we're seeing today.
And what would you say to, you know, our congresspeople and President Biden? What should the American government be doing at this point?
We would say we urge them to refrain from providing additional military aid to Israel and instead to prioritize diplomatic efforts at working toward a ceasefire and opening humanitarian corridors for the people in Gaza.
In reality, how does one come to peace at this point, given the 75-year occupation and the loss of so much land and water?
I don't think we're going to get to peace very easily or very soon. But that does not mean that we should stop advocating for peace and advocating for justice. Many people said the same thing about the situation under the apartheid government in South Africa, and things did change. It's going to be a long, long struggle, but we need to keep advocating for peace.
My name is Rabbi David Feldman. I'm with Neturei Karta International, Jews United Against Zionism. I happen to be from Brooklyn County, the rest of my group from Orange County, not so far away from here. We are Jewish communities. We are so upset to all what's going on in Palestine already for decades. All what we are experiencing the last couple of days is just a continuation. Nothing started now. Nothing started a week ago. All of this started over 75 years ago when this brutal occupation of Palestine first started, oppressing an entire people. Happens to be in total contrast to basics of Judaism. This is forbidden. This occupation is forbidden from beginning to end. And sadly, we have a state of Israel insisting that they represent all Jews, and they act in the name of all Jews, and they act, unfortunately, in the name of the Jewish religion. This is not the Jewish religion. This is not the opinion of the masses of Jewish people. We have masses of Jewish people in the United States, in Palestine, and the world over, who oppose this occupation in its entirety. If we are truly looking for a solution, if we want to see a long-lasting solution, we have to search and understand what is the root cause behind all of this. Otherwise, we would never reach the right solution. The root cause here is not a difference of religion. We had differences of religions for a very long time before all this terrible situation started decades ago. It is the occupation which is destroying the Palestinian people and endangering the Jewish people as well. We don't need the state of Israel to protect us. We were protected by Muslims for a very long time. We don't want to have a state of Israel to endanger the Jewish people the world over.
Thank you very much.
My name is Karen Carmelli. I'm out here today representing Albany's chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm an Israeli-American citizen. I lived in Israel for 16 years, and I left before being drafted into the Israeli military. I'm also the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, and what I'm seeing in Palestine right now is an absolute genocide, and I feel like it's my responsibility to be here and speak out against it. My grandfather, who survived the Holocaust by the skin of his teeth at the age of 11, his entire family was murdered by Nazis, always instilled in me the value of never again. Never again is now. It is our duty to speak out, and that's why I'm here today.
And how does one respond to Israelis' concern about they want to be feel protected?
Everyone wants to feel protected, and everyone deserves the right to be protected. What Hamas did, the murder of Israeli civilians, including children, was abhorrent. And what we are calling for today is a ceasefire to make sure that more children and more innocent civilians aren't killed in this bloody conflict that has roots in a 75-year-old occupation.
Thank you very much.
My name is Tom Ellis. I live in Albany, and I work with the Palestinian Rights Committee. And we're here today for a number of reasons. One is we're calling upon the United States government to demand that the Israeli government open the pipes again and allow water into Gaza. They haven't allowed water into Gaza in more than a week, and people are probably already dying of thirst by now, and they certainly will be very soon, that most of the water in Gaza is polluted. We're also calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and we're calling for a release of the political prisoners and the captives on both sides. And we're calling for allowing the humanitarian aid to come in. And we're calling for, God, what are we calling? Sorry. We're calling for an end to the siege, if I didn't already say that, and opening up Gaza to the outside world again.
How has our local congresspeople been responding to the situation? And are they trying to push the Biden administration for more even-handed policy?
I know that Schumer and Gillibrand are not. Tonko, I'm not sure. I know that Schumer was quoted a few days ago of accusing Hamas of unprecedented viciousness, and which I think is like rather hypocritical on his part, considering that Hamas may be as vicious as Israel, but Israel does it on a vastly greater scale, and they've done it for 75 years.
If people are interested in finding out more, particularly about the local chapter of the Palestinian Rights Committee, how best can they do that?
They could contact me at tomellis107@gmail.com. We're going to have our website up and running within a couple of weeks.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Carl Strock with the Palestinian Rights Committee. One of the things I'm distressed about here is that this is going to make, and by this I mean the current disaster in Gaza, Palestine, is going to make media coverage even more slanted than it was. Before, there was very little justification for seeing Israel as the good guys and the Palestinians as the bad guys. But this, the massacre that occurred, the invasion on October 7th, I'm afraid, makes the media's job easier in a way. It's easier for them to push the line that the Palestinians are the victims, and that the Israelis are the victims. And the Palestinians are the aggressors. I'm sorry to see that.
And I understand you actually visited the occupied territories, and what was your impression on that visit?
I did. I visited the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It's been quite a while now. It's been, I think, 11 years. And that turned my mind on this. I had not previously been all that concerned with Israel and Palestine, and that opened my eyes. It was a shock to me, frankly. It was really a shock to see how the Palestinians were treated, how they had lost their land, how they'd been dispossessed. I met ordinary Palestinian people. I had a Palestinian interpreter with me, and it kind of changed my life in a way. It really did.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Well, beloved, we are back, and we are here with Reverend Dr. Tanya Mays of Serenity Wellness and Spa in Columbia Street in Hudson, New York. And just delighted to be here with her. Known her for ages. Full disclosure, good friend, sister in God, member, extended member of Overcomer Ministries, but an excellent, excellent healthcare provider. And she has consented to join us for a conversation about breast cancer awareness. In observance of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we want to help all those who are out here listening to know what's available and to be proactive in your health care. So this could be for you, your sister, your daughter, your mama, or your friend. Listen and be blessed, all right? So Reverend Minister Doctor Tanya Mays, welcome to the Tuesday afternoon show. And as we do with all our guests, we invite you to give a 60-second self-introduction. Who is Tanya Mays?
Tanya Mays is a child of God, someone who loves the Lord, and someone who, according to the scripture in Jeremiah, was ordained for the womb to be a physician. But I'm a child of God first. I love the things of God, and my life has been directed to do the best that I can according to His will and purpose with the skill and anointing that He has given me. So I sort of do a lot of other stuff other than just being a physician, but I do as a mother, I do as a counselor, I do as a sister, I do as a friend according to what God has led me to do.
So, and a wife.
And a wife, yes, that's true. I'm a wife.
Of how many
sister,
years?
And a mother and doctor. We've been married for 23 years, Pierre. And I had a dream about him the other day. It was amazing. And I said, God chose you as my husband. So
you had a dream about your hubby. That's beautiful. Was it a beautiful dream?
Oh, yeah, it was nice because I don't even know, you know, where these dreams come from. And that's a whole nother spiritual component that I'm wanting to mature with the Lord about. And it just said, I was telling someone else, God chose him to be my husband. It was not a choice. God chose him to be my husband. So, and that's great, you know, nowadays when the divorce rate is 50%. But
exactly.
Yeah.
All right. That is another conversation for another day. And we certainly will have that one. It's going to help somebody, maybe help me. So praise the Lord. But we are here to talk about breast cancer awareness, right? And so, let's just jump into that conversation. What's going on with breast cancer these days?
So I like to actually say breast health awareness.
Excellent.
You know, cancer, we don't know what causes cancer, whether it's breast cancer or any other part of the body. We don't know. And I also believe in divine healing and miracle. I always try to speak in a positive because there's death and life in the tongue. So I rather address it as breast health awareness just to start off. But yes, I think it's important because the Bible says my people perish because of lack of knowledge. So it's important to know about your body. It's important to know what tests to get done, when to get tested and screened for, when a biopsy is appropriate. All of these things are critical in terms of breast health.
I love the way you would phrase that, you know, and that is so, I mean, I feel inspired and encouraged even the more, because I know a lot of times you think about, oh, I got to go get this checkup, and oh, I got to go do this mammogram, and oh, you know, and there's a lot of anxiety or discomfort, you know, you're anticipating the discomfort, and you're anticipating something negative might happen, or you're at least hoping that something good will come out of it. But when you come at it as I'm taking care of my health, my physical health, my breast health, that's inspiring.
Yes. I think it's important to bring it down a whole lot of notches in terms of stress. Stress has never been proven to be healthy. I think stress comes from the spirit of fear. And excuse me if I sound too spiritual or non-scientific, but God created the body, the science behind the body. And so, and God is a spirit, and all those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. And I know I'm not a preacher, I'm a teacher. And you asked who I was. I'm a mother, a daughter, a child of Christ. So I'm going to be bringing in spiritual stuff. It's just in my genes, my genetics. But I'm totally a doctor. I have an MD, board certified and scientific, and ordained by God to say these things scientifically and spiritually.
So, and anxiety, award winner, too.
Award-winning, that, well, thank you. You bring that up. I don't even recognize that, but yeah, I've been recognized for my gifting, that and all the glory belongs to God, really. I don't even know how I get these awards. I don't do anything extra. I just be, and God just has people recognize me, so.
Yes, yes, yeah. He will. So for people who, particularly, I'm going to start with young women. What is the advice or counsel for young women? You know, I heard somebody say, you know you're old when you keep your doctor appointments. You know, when you're young, like, when was the last time you went to the doctor? Oh, I don't even remember. But after you get a certain age, you'd be like, it's all about the doctor appointments, right? What advice would you give to young women about when to start, you know, thinking about their breast health?
Well, I think the terminology young is relative, you know, or relative to. I was talking to my son who was 10 or 8 at that time, and I was telling him that the 50 is a new 40, the 60 mm-hmm. is a new 50, mm-hmm. and he looked at me like in bewilderment, and he's like, Mom, I don't know what that means, but I think by the time you're 80, you're old, though. So it's all relative, but essentially, I go by the American Cancer Society recommendations who have done the research. There's not a whole lot of people doing research because it takes money. But essentially, recommendation is that you do screening at age 40, okay? 40 is not old, I think, especially once you get there. So, and what I tell people is that you need to be aware of your breasts, okay? In 23 years of experience, I had a patient who was 16 who unfortunately had breast cancer. That is not the norm, okay? But she came in, I remember vividly, because I was an intern, and her mother found a lump, she found a lump, and they were like, you know, what does this mean? I'm too young, is it, you know? And then I told her the differential diagnosis, and most often when there's a breast mass in a young person, it's a fibroadenoma, and those are benign breast disease, and then there's malignant breast disease. But the American Cancer Society recommends being aware of your breasts all the time, ever since development, just feeling them, feeling if your armpit. Self-examination is very critical, you know, because you're with your breasts all day, 24/7. You know, you only go to the doctor whenever you're going to go for whatever physical exam, if it's required for work. And some doctors don't even do a breast exam, although that's now required by a primary care physician. But if you go to OBGYN, you know, they're doing a breast exam typically, if you consent to it. But you need to examine your breasts, and it's not hard to do. A lot of patients will say, well, I don't know how to do a breast exam. It's just examining, feeling, and noting what your breasts are like. And once you're familiar with the way your breasts feel, when there's something that you haven't felt before, then you should bring it to the doctor's attention. And anything that feels like a pea or a marble, that's something that should be brought to attention. Most patients who have, unfortunately, been diagnosed with breast cancer, they have found their own lump. It wasn't the doctor, mm-hmm. most often. So it's really critical, because if most people are finding it on their own and you want to catch these things early, then we know, examine your own breath.